These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. The Great Courses cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the teaching company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. These lectures are titled Buddhism, Part 1. The lecturer is Professor Malcolm David Eccle. Dr. Eccle is an associate professor of religion at Boston University, where he has been teaching for over 10 years. He holds two bachelor's degrees, one in English from Harvard University and a second in theology from Oxford University. He went on to earn his master's in theology at Oxford and his PhD in the study of comparative religion at Harvard. In addition to his position at Boston University, he has held teaching positions at Ohio Wesleyan University, Middlebury College, and the Harvard Divinity School. At Boston University, Professor Eccle has taught courses on Buddhism, comparative religion, and the religions of Asia. In 1998, Professor Eccle received the Metcalf Award for Teaching Excellence, the university's highest award for teaching. In addition to many articles, Professor Eccle has published two books on Buddhist philosophy, including To See the Buddha, A Philosopher's Quest for the Meaning of Emptiness. Professor Eccle prepared the course guide that comes with these tapes. The course guide includes a detailed outline of each lecture, a glossary, a timeline, biographical notes, and a bibliography. To get the most out of this course, you may find it useful to follow along with the outlines or review them before or after each lecture. Lecture 1. What is Buddhism?
Welcome to our course on the history of Buddhism. My name is David Eccle. I teach about Buddhism in the religion department at Boston University, and I'm absolutely delighted to be here to be able to share with you my interest in this remarkable and lively and perpetually challenging religious tradition. You might be interested, just as we start this series of lectures, about how I became involved in the study of Buddhism. I didn't grow up in a Buddhist environment. I suspect that that's true also for many of you. I came to Buddhism when I was a young man studying Christian theology at Oxford. And one of the biggest challenges we faced in those days was to try to find something to fill our long four-month summer vacation between the 2 years of our program. And I, being the naive guy that I was in those days, signed up to do an expedition to the desert of central Iran to study the life of Iranian nomads. And we got out to the desert and I'm sorry to say that we found no nomads other than ourselves. But when we got to the end of that trip, as I was sitting under the great Mongol dome in the Friday Mosque in Isfahan, gazing up into the brickwork, I began to muse a little bit about a lot of the things that I had seen, and I decided that I wanted to do nothing more with my life than to study the civilizations of Asia. So I went back to Oxford and began to study Sanskrit, the language of India, and followed my nose and eventually ended up at Harvard studying comparative religion and Buddhism. One thing led to another, and I found myself swimming happily through the philosophical traditions of the Indian Buddhist community, and also the philosophical traditions of Tibet. And Buddhism has become really an endless source of fascination, I would have to say, for me. And I'm looking forward very much to having a chance to share that fascination with you in this course. In this introductory lecture, I'd like to give you a brief overview of the history of Buddhism, Our course is going to follow a historical trajectory from the Buddhists of ancient India to the Buddhists who have become such an important life and such an important component in our own neighborhoods here in North America. So this overview of Buddhist history will give you, I think, a clear impression of the ground we will cover together in these lectures. I'd also like to say something about my own approach to the study of Buddhism. I think it's important not just to know the history of Buddhism, but to find some way, if we can, this is not always easy, especially when we're talking about people who lived many centuries ago, but if we can, I'd like to find a way to get inside the hearts and the minds, somewhere in here, wherever that mind is located, in the center of the personality, so that we can understand the people who have made Buddhism such a dynamic component in Asian civilization, and now, of course, are making Buddhism such a dynamic part of the civilization of the rest of the world. Finally, I'd like to comment on some of the things that have made Buddhism such an endless source of fascination for me, and also some of the things that I hope will become fascinating to you as well. So let me begin by talking about the origin and the expansion of Buddhism from its homeland in northern India. Buddhism began in northern India around 500 years BCE. BCE, as we use it, that abbreviation commonly in the study of religion, means before the Common Era or before the Christian era. The Buddhist tradition gets its name from a man who was known by his followers as the Buddha, or the Awakened One. He was born in a princely family in a region of northern India that now lies in southern Nepal. In those days, of course, it was simply part of the great undifferentiated geographical entity that we speak of now as the Indian subcontinent. I suspect that all of you who are listening to this lecture have an image in your minds already of what a Buddha looks like. I have one sitting right behind me now as I speak. The Buddha often is depicted as sitting very serenely in a state of contemplation. His feet are crossed in front of him in a position that we know as the lotus position. I'd love to be able to imitate it to you, but I'm afraid that capacity has gone with many of my old yogic attainments from an earlier life. The Buddha is a very picture of calm and contemplation. That clearly is what a Buddha is. And this is the image of this calm and contemplative human being that has drawn many people to the Buddha for centuries in Asia and here, of course, in our own environment today. This is the one that conveys most explicitly the experience of his awakening. But the Buddha did not always sit in perfect contemplation, of course. After his awakening, he got up from the seat of his enlightenment and taught about his experience to others on the roads of northern India. The major events of his life took place in what we call the Madhya Desha, or the middle region of the Ganges Basin. These sites are still the focus of Buddhist pilgrimage today. To understand the significance of the Buddha's life, we will spend two of our lectures, right at the beginning of the course, studying the religious background that the Buddha confronted himself in India during his own lifetime. The background that made it possible for the Buddha to have such a strong religious impact on Indian civilization. Then we'll discuss the three categories or jewels that are fundamental to Buddhist life. We'll spend one lecture on the life of the Buddha himself, two lectures on his teaching or his Dharma, and then one lecture on the development of the early Buddhist community and one lecture on the tradition of Buddhist art. Once we've set ourselves down firmly, just put our feet down in these early aspects of the Buddhist tradition, then our challenge will be to understand the extraordinary diversity of Buddhism as it evolved in India and then throughout the countries of Asia. In India itself, there were two major reform movements that appeared within the Buddhist community not so long after the lifetime of the Buddha himself. One of these was called the Mahayana, or the Great Vehicle, and the second was called Tantra. And the word Tantra we'll talk about when the time comes for us to discuss that movement in more detail, but for the moment, I think it might be helpful for us simply to imagine that the word Tantra means power. This was a tradition in the Indian Buddhist community that emphasized all the techniques that cultivated a sense of power. These two movements will each get some very significant attention in separate lectures. Before these movements had ever begun to brew in India, Buddhism was carried to Sri Lanka, the island that used to be called Ceylon, just off the southern tip of India, carried by Buddhist missionaries in the 3rd century BCE. And from Sri Lanka, Buddhism was then carried on to most of Southeast Asia, including Indonesia. We don't think of Indonesia now as being a particularly Buddhist country, but some of the most extraordinary monuments in the history of Buddhism are found in Indonesia. Buddhism moved north out of India into China in the 2nd century of the Common Era, carried north by monks and by merchants on the trade routes that went out over the mountains of the Hindu Kush into Afghanistan and then on into the great trade routes called the Silk Road that moved across Central Asia and into the major mercantile centers of northern China. Here, Buddhism encountered, of course, a sophisticated and ancient civilization. China was a confident and thoroughly civilized region when these early Buddhist monks began to make contact with Chinese civilization. And for Buddhism to become part of China, as it eventually did, it was important for Buddhists to make some major changes in the way they thought through and expressed basic issues in Buddhist civilization. So one of our preoccupations later in this course will be all these subtle ways that Buddhism transformed itself in order to become thoroughly Chinese. From China, Buddhism was eventually carried to Korea, Japan, and Vietnam. So as you think schematically here at the beginning of our study about the different varieties of Buddhism in the world, you might lump Korean, Japanese, and Vietnamese Buddhism together as expressions of this great East Asian strand within the larger complex of the Buddhist tradition as a whole. In the 8th century of the Common Era, Buddhism was carried across the Himalayas from India into Tibet. Today, the Dalai Lama, who is the leader of the Tibetan Buddhist community, is one of the most visible, and I think probably one of the most active Buddhist leaders in the world. In many ways, certainly he's been this way for me, he is not just a living symbol of Tibetan Buddhism, but really, for many people, he's been a symbol of Buddhism itself. We'll give separate attention to all these major varieties of Buddhism in these different cultural areas. And we'll conclude our course with a brief look at the way Buddhism has become part of the religious world we know in our own neighborhoods in Europe, North America, and in other parts of the contemporary world. Today, Buddhism has spread through much of the rest of the world, including Europe, Australia, and the Americas. I was climbing Mount Kosciuszko, the great mountain, the highest mountain in Australia. Whether we call this great or not, we'll have to discuss. But it was certainly a formidable and an interesting mountain on a trip to Australia last year. And as I was staying in one of the hostels that hikers and climbers and skiers use before they go off to climb the mountain, I ran into a group of Australian Buddhists. I was happy to know that Tibetan Buddhism was alive and well and functioning very actively and actually in quite a sophisticated sophisticated way in Sydney and in some of the other cities of Australia. So Buddhism has really become a part of our modern world, and we rub shoulders with it in all sorts of ways. In America, Buddhism in some places is strongest in ethnic communities, as it is in the Sri Lankan Buddhist Sangha, the Buddhist community in Los Angeles, or in the Buddhist Churches of America, an important Japanese-based Buddhist community that is centered particularly in California and in Hawaii, but also has centers in New York and on the East Coast. It also has become extremely influential with communities of American converts. One of the most intriguing developments that we'll discuss in my final lecture has been the appearance of a whole new generation of indigenous European and American Buddhist leaders. Some of these leaders, like the 19th century theosophist, who was known as Colonel Olcott, and others, like the Boston Buddhists, who were led particularly by Ernest Fenollosa, have not only shaped the development of Buddhism here in America, but also in very curious and important ways shaped the modernization of Buddhism, shaped the development of Buddhism in Asia as well. Colonel Olcott not only helped bring Buddhism to America, but he shaped very much how the Sri Lankans understood their own tradition, and the Boston Buddhists, Fenollosa and some of his colleagues, helped members of the Japanese imperial court appropriate and protect aspects of their heritage that had fallen out of fashion in the late 19th century. So as we study American Buddhism, we'll be studying also, in a funny way, the internationalization of Buddhism and the feedback, the relationship between American Buddhists and the Buddhists of Asia. So as you can imagine, this long and complex history has made the Buddhist tradition extraordinarily diverse. This will be one of the issues we'll have to confront in the course of these lectures. Some Buddhists, for example, uphold the very austere tradition of self-reliance found in the early Buddhist monastic community, relying simply on yourself in order to achieve the experience of nirvana that the Buddha himself achieved. One example of this is the monastic practice in the Theravada Buddhist countries of Southeast Asia, particularly Sri Lanka, where the center of Buddhist activity lies largely in the monastery, among a group of yellow-robed monks who go out in the morning in a very austere and simple way with their begging bowls, walking from house to house, holding out their bowls, taking off the lid and inviting members of the lay community to provide them with the alms that will sustain them for that day. One of the classic rules in traditional Buddhism is that monks can't carry food from one day to the next. So every morning, those monks have to go out in their robes with their bowls to beg their food. That austere, simple tradition is a tradition that really grows right out of the experience of the Buddha from the earliest stages in the growth of the Buddhist tradition. You find the same kind of self-reliance in the Zen tradition in Japan. I was just visiting in Japan a couple of weeks ago as part of a conference, and I went down to Kyoto, the great imperial capital of Japan, and visited with a wonderful Zen abbot who was the head of one of the monasteries in one of the monastic compounds in the monastery called Daitokuji. And I was speaking to him and taking his photograph, and as I focused my camera on him, I told him how important it was going to be for my students to be able to show them a picture of a Zen master who was clearly so accomplished, who had clearly embodied in a powerful way the truths of that tradition. And he looked me straight in the eye and he said, "Now I want you to tell them when you speak to them about this tradition to be courageous, to stand up straight, and to rely on themselves." And I found myself, I, like many people in my business, have a little bit of a scholar's stoop, and I found myself just standing up a little straighter, trying to imagine in some way that I had imbibed the courage and the sense of self-reliance that he was attempting to teach me. That, of course, is a deeply rooted aspect of the Buddhist tradition. It grows right out of the Buddha's own experience, and it's one of the ways of being a Buddhist in the world. It's not the only way. There also is another important aspect of the tradition that insists that it's not really possible, and perhaps not even desirable, to achieve salvation purely on your own merit, purely on your own, relying on your own power, but instead to rely on the power of some deity, some figure who is infinitely greater than you. One example of this that we'll study in some detail as the course goes on is the worship of the Buddha Amida, Amida Buddha, by Pure Land Buddhists in Japan. Pure Land Buddhism has, of course, come to North America, like many other varieties of Buddhism, and in some of its manifestations in this country in particular, it looks an awful lot like Christian devotion. I was visiting not so long ago in one of the Pure Land Buddhist temples in Hawaii, and being the curious scholar that I was, I opened up a little hymnal in the back of the temple and looked at, I think it was the first hymn, perhaps it was the second, and it had words that seemed mysteriously familiar to me. It began, "Buddha loves me, this I know, for the sutras tell me so." You could probably sing that along with me if you wanted to do that. I suspect you know the tune. It, of course, is not a traditional Buddhist hymn, but a way of simply mapping Buddhist devotion into a form that would be familiar to people, especially to children, in American culture. Another example of Buddhist devotion that will occupy some of our attention here in the next few lectures is Chinese Buddhist devotion to the Bodhisattva, or the future Buddha, not a Buddha per se, but a deity who will become a Buddha in a future life, the Bodhisattva Guanyin. Guanyin is often pictured as a beautiful standing female figure holding a baby. And in Chinese civilization, Guanyin is viewed as being the embodiment of compassion, but compassion particularly associated with the development of a healthy and happy family and the gift of children. So when I was visiting at a Chinese Buddhist pilgrimage site on an island off Shanghai a couple of years ago, I ran into a group of Chinese Buddhists, ethnic Chinese Buddhists, who came from the Philippines and from Indonesia. I asked them why they had made the long and rather arduous and rather expensive trip to come to this island to pay homage to the deity Guanyin, and they said that it was for the welfare of their family, and particularly as a way of hoping, fulfilling the hope, to have children, happy children themselves. This is an aspect of Buddhism that for many people might seem unfamiliar, but it too is deeply rooted in the practice of the Indian tradition and will need to occupy some of our attention. In Tibet, one of the most important aspects of religious devotion is focused not necessarily on these great celestial figures, but on the human beings who embody their power. The Dalai Lama, in particular, is one of these. People think of the Dalai Lama sometimes as being a living Buddha. Technically, that's not correct. He's a living manifestation of the compassion of the same Bodhisattva who is manifested as Guanyin in China. But he, too, has an extraordinary ability to make the power of compassion present for people. I remember a moment, for example, A few years ago, when the Dalai Lama was making a visit to Middlebury College in Vermont, and a lot of people had come to gather, as you do in settings like that, on a whole mess of folding chairs spread out in the field house at Middlebury. And as we were waiting for the Dalai Lama to come, we were buzzing in conversation, as you do. There was this sort of hum of anxious expectation in the room as we were waiting for him to arrive. And then we heard the door open in the back of the field house, and there was a hush that settled on the audience. We all turned around and looked back to see what was coming, and there the Dalai Lama, wrapped in his red robes and surrounded by his retinue of monks, came into the room. Bending over slightly, he has a remarkable way, actually, to embody a certain quality of humility. He had his hands folded in front of him in that gesture of respect that's common in the Indian and Tibetan tradition. And he, with a lovely half-smile on his face, he searched the eyes of the people there in the audience and in some remarkable way managed to make eye contact with each one of us. And I think no matter how skeptical we were or how unfamiliar we were with the traditions of Tibetan Buddhism, we could feel some of the power of compassion that is associated with that person. That, too, is an important aspect of the Buddhist tradition, not just relying on yourself, but in a sense opening yourself to the power that comes to you from a figure who in some way embodies an influence that is much greater than you. Now, if we're thinking about the diversity of the Buddhist tradition, it's also important to remember that not all Buddhists are devotees, monks, nuns, or, for that matter, embodiments of extraordinary otherworldly powers. Buddhism also has been concerned very deeply in ways that might be surprising to many of you in political life in Asia. King Ashoka, an emperor in the Maurya dynasty who reigned in the 3rd century before the Common Era, converted to Buddhism and became a protector of the Buddhist tradition and established in Buddhist history an ideal that's known as the Dharma Raja, the righteous king, who is a protector and a promoter and a defender of the Buddhist tradition. Ashoka's ideal has been imitated in traditional Buddhist societies as different as Thailand and Indonesia, China, Japan, very important actually, in the expansion of Buddhism into each of those cultures. And it's alive today in quite a fascinating way in the figure of Aung San Suu Kyi, who is politician, a political leader, a leader of a democratic protest movement in Myanmar, which is formerly known by the name of Burma. We'll discuss some of her life. She was a recipient of a Nobel Peace Prize and is a remarkable embodiment of what you might call modern, contemporary, democratic Buddhist political values. So a full description of a Buddhist society would have to include not just monks, nuns, and devotees, but all the kings, queens, donors, supporters who have oriented themselves in one way or another to the ideal of the Buddha and supported Buddhist institutions and helped spread Buddhist values throughout the world. Now, as we move through our discussion of Buddhist teaching, we'll see that the diversity of the Buddhist tradition should come to us as no surprise, really. The Buddha himself said that everything is impermanent, all things pass away. So the evolution of the Buddhist tradition itself exemplifies this fundamental truth. It constantly changes. There's nothing that seems absolutely to be set in stone. It constantly evolves. And we ourselves will want to begin to feel the dynamism of that evolution, that process of change. The Buddha also said that nothing has any permanent identity. This is the famous Buddhist doctrine of no self. So as the Buddhist tradition has changed and adapted to new situations and needs, it sometimes seems to have changed so radically that it's hard to know anymore what makes it Buddhist. So the question for us, really, is in the face of this incredible diversity, is there any way for us to say what Buddhism actually is? What is it? What is it that we're going to study in this course of lectures? It probably, to be honest, would be difficult to answer that question in a way that would satisfy everyone who has looked to the Buddha for guidance, or everyone who has thought of himself or herself as being a Buddhist. But I'm convinced that the best way for us to understand this tradition is to see it as the continuous unfolding of a set of stories. Buddhists love to tell stories, and I love to tell stories, and I suspect that's true also of many of you. So that this course will begin by telling some of the stories that gave a distinctive character to Indian civilization. It'll move on to the story of the Buddha. As that story was remembered and then transformed by generations of his followers. Then it will move on to the stories of a few of the people who have used the model of the Buddha's life to shape their own lives and to shape, in a profound way, the civilizations where they live. Finally, I hope that the story of the Buddha and the story of Buddhism will in some way become your story as well. Buddhism can be a great challenge to people who have grown up in the Western world and think that religion has to do with the worship of a single, almighty God. The Buddha didn't accept the existence of a single God who created the world. And for that matter, he did not accept the idea of a permanent self. Some people think, in fact, that Buddhism is so different from all we know as religion in the Western world that it should be called, perhaps, a philosophy of life rather than a religion. Either way, Buddhism challenges us to think in new ways, to think in new ways about the nature of the world and about the possibility of a satisfying and productive human life. I think that you will find it's well worth spending a few hours learning to look at this world through Buddhist eyes.